and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the food charity Oxfam is reeling after reports that some of its senior staff members in Haiti trafficked prostitutes, including underage girls. The allegations are not new. Oxfam had earlier been accused of similar behavior in Chad, South Sudan, and Liberia. Next, with the 2018 Winter Olympics ending on Sunday, North and South Korea are looking at what could be a breakthrough in their relations. But will pressure from the Trump administration end any chance of peace talks? Then, manufacturing giant 3M agreed yesterday to pay the state of Minnesota $850 million for water quality programs after it was found to have illegally dumped dangerous chemicals in Twin Cities waterways. Those chemicals have made their way into the groundwater. And then, an Idaho lawmaker has introduced a new bill that would allow health insurance carriers to offer non-Obamacare-approved plans while also imposing new requirements for Medicaid recipients. If passed, many health insurance plans in Idaho would not meet the minimum requirements set by Obamacare. And finally, Senator Mike Enzi, a conservative Republican from Wyoming and chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, has sent a letter to the Pentagon saying that if the Defense Department can't manage its own accounting, then perhaps Congress may have to withhold that huge budget increase it just passed. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Haiti. The food charity Oxfam is reeling after reports that some of its senior staff members in Haiti trafficked prostitutes, including underage girls. The allegations are not new. Oxfam had earlier been accused of similar behavior in Chad, South Sudan, and Liberia. And just this afternoon, the Haitian government suspended all Oxfam activities in the country. We're joined in studio by Kim Ives. He's the editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. Welcome.
Thank you, John.
So can you explain to our listeners how this whole thing started? What exactly is Oxfam being accused of doing?
Well, they're being accused of holding Caligula-style orgies with underage Haitian girls, their properties, their homes in Haiti, shortly after the earthquake. They were supposed to be there helping victims of the earthquake recover, and instead were engaging, it appears, in prostitution and a very exploitative relationship with their would-be beneficiaries of their aid.
You know, that's, it's not child prostitution. It's just rape.
It's rape.
What Oxfam executives are doing is raping children.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this was not just some low-level employees, but apparently the country director. He claims it was a consensual relationship, but it appears that it was enough for him to be fired, but he was allowed to resign, and not just resign, but the Oxfam leadership was writing recommendations for him for other NGOs.
Oh, and the government of Haiti either didn't prosecute or wasn't able to prosecute, is that right?
Or didn't know about it. You know, this is the whole problem. And in a way, Oxfam, a lot of people are sort of wringing their hands going, well, Oxfam, they're the good one. You know, they're supposed to be the one. They have the index which shows the effects of capitalism on the world and how the divide between rich and poor is growing and are supposed to be sort of the enlightened NGO. But the fact is they're part of the whole NGO phenomenon, which is I think just to step back and give the listeners a idea of the whole arc of the emergence of the NGOs. I mean, we began with a world which used to be the colonial countries and their colonies, and that gradually began to dissipate 60 years ago as countries got their independence. And sometimes they had independent governments which came in to power, and unfortunately, the U.S. didn't like many of them and began to overthrow regimes because they had maybe a socialist point of view or a nationalist point of view. And we began to see governments which would be basically put in place through U.S. or European money, and their power would be enforced by multinational peacekeepers. This is what we see in Haiti. But part of it is not just the multinational peacekeepers who are sort of the bad cop, but you have the good cops, which are basically the NGOs. They come in and they fill the gap that these weakened states, or we can, you know, sometimes they call them failed states, can't do. They help put in the drainage ditch or the latrine or the school or the hospital. And then they also siphon off what used to be the revolutionary intelligentsia. You know, here are guys who used to be fighting to regain their state and their sovereignty, but instead now they're driving, you know, 4x4s and have a salary of, you know, several grand, tens of thousands of dollars sometimes a year. And so it's sort of a cancer.
Let's talk about what that actually looked like in Haiti. Again, we had the earthquake. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people died, right?
Well, really tens of thousands. Again, this is part of the, and there's a very good book, Brian, by a guy called Tim Schwartz, who's worked there for about three decades, and it's called The Great Haiti Humanitarian Aid Swindle. And this humanitarian aid sector is the eighth largest economy in the world, and part of their job is to inflate numbers. So they said there were 316,000. I mean, the Haitian government said it, but they clapped for that. But when he actually did a study, he found that between 46 and 84,000 people died. And this was pretty much undisputable.
Yeah. So we have this grave crisis, tens of thousands dead, even if the numbers, the official, quote, official numbers are inflated, tens of thousands dead. The Haitian government, which is weak, is unable to deal with the crisis.
Right.
So in come the foreign NGOs,
right,
and they actually function as an independent, almost state next to the state, a parallel
exactly.
state without accountability.
Yeah.
So it's a replication of the colonial, it's a microcosm of colonial type relationships.
Exactly.
But this time with the, instead of soldiers with bayonets, you have the crown of noble good deeds.
These are the new missionaries.
Yeah.
And some of them are missionaries. In fact, some of them come in a religious garb and they're Protestant or whatever. But a lot of it are secular. They're the Oxfams. They're the World Visions. They're the Save the Children's. And these are all now what we're seeing. But it's essentially an elitist, oppressive and exploitative relationship that they have with these uncivilized people who don't have the wherewithal to govern themselves. And, you know, and this is the very insidious and nefarious aspect of the NGOs, is they really undermine the sovereignty and ability of these countries for self-determination.
And they're generating a lot of money. So we have constant television ads, which are expensive, broadcast into the homes, the living rooms of people in the United States. Give to Oxfam or this one or that one to help the poor people in Haiti. Again, it's built on the aid industry's sort of white savior mentality,
exactly.
colonial, racist paradigm.
Right.
And at the same time, as we can see in the case of Oxfam, just doing whatever they want, like a rule unto themselves. If it wasn't for the Me Too movement, if it wasn't for these other exposés, this kind of stuff would be like the normal business as usual. Let's face it.
Right.
That's what they're doing. And they're raping Haitian children.
Right.
That's what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people they're supposedly helping because people are so poor that they need money. And then they're engaging them as, quote, prostitutes. But in fact, it's a kind of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a modern form of slavery, but done now by the humanitarian Oxfam nonprofit complex. There's also peacekeepers who have been in Haiti after the coup d'etat that ousted Aristide. Again, the U.S. was heavily involved in that coup d'etat.
They were wholly behind it.
And then, and explain that real quick, and also what's the role then of the U.N. peacekeepers? Talk about that.
Well, that's just it. I mean, the bad cops, if we can call them that, the U.N. peacekeepers, which were deployed in Haiti under an operation called the UN Mission to Stabilize Haiti, MINUSTA, there were multiple cases of rape. There were 117 Sri Lankan peacekeepers based out in Laogan in Haiti who had to be sent back because they had a whole ring of the operation where they were bringing in these teenagers, having sex with them, boys and girls. And, you know, this all went unpunished. They were never able to be prosecuted in Haiti.
They send them home.
They send them home, and you know, maybe there's something there or not. Some Uruguayans were judged back in Uruguay for basically a videotape went viral where they were seen essentially sodomizing a boy. And so this impunity permeates, and you know, it begins to warp the whole culture in a sense, because you know, after a while, people are in a way will come and even offer themselves, if I can put it like that, because that's how you're going to eat. And these peacekeepers or maybe NGO employees will come and say, okay, here's some food, but, you know, here's my bed. So this is what ends up really creating this tremendous cancer in the society.
Earlier today, Oxfam's operations in Haiti were suspended. Again, talk about the Haitian government's response.
Well, they are fleeing in front of what is reality. They weren't the ones to raise it, but it's been an open secret. You know, people have known this has been going on for years, and it's just part of the debilitation of the Haitian government, which has been really it's really been a U.S. policy, and I can say European policy. That is the former colonial countries. What we could call the neo-colonial countries, basically encourage this weakening of the state in these nations. And they say it's poor governance. You know, the people don't have an understanding of democracy and blah, 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 blah. But they are the ones, in fact, and we can see it even in the elections, which are happening. How can a government, which is essentially a neo-devaluous government in Haiti, come to power? It's through the meddling, through the U.S. coming in and revamping the whole electoral system, much like it is here, the same way they've, you know, done gerrymandering and rigging and basically discouraging the vote here. They did it in Haiti. If you look at the election in 1990, which was basically a Haitian setup system, you had massive participation, somewhere up in the order of 90%. But today, it was less than 20% that took part in the 2015 and 16, and this is because they've centralized the voting centers. They've made long lists. It's impossible for people to participate. So the whole NGO peacekeeping, quote unquote, basically interventionist military occupations are part of this crushing of democracy in neo-colonies like Haiti.
That was the voice of Kim Ives. He joined us here in the studio in Washington. He is the editor of the newspaper Haiti Liberté. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Brian Becker.
With the 2018 Winter Olympics ending on Sunday, North and South Korea are looking at what could be a breakthrough in their relations. But will pressure from the Trump administration end any chance of peace talks? We're joined in the studio by Dr. Emmanuel Pastoreich. He's the director of the Asia Institute in Seoul, South Korea. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So my first question is, the North Koreans sent a high-level delegation to the opening of the Olympics. They're sending an almost equally high-level delegation to the closing ceremonies of
Correct.
The Olympics. What does that mean for Korea, and what's the U.S. response to it?
Well, I think we can see this as a considerable acceleration beyond what the current South Korean Moon Jae-in administration, I think, had anticipated. They imagined they, over the course of years, they would work to normalize relations. But the Trump administration has become so completely unpredictable that people are very seriously worried that some sort of a current term is bloody nose
bloody
attack,
nose.
Some sort of provocative unilateral attack by the United States is being, I mean, there's evidence, is seriously being prepared for. And so they're under the gun to create an environment on the Korean Peninsula, which is so sort of positive cycle, that they're able to preempt this aggressive attempt to militarize and create a conflict.
Okay, let's talk about the timing issue, because timing could be everything.
Yes.
There's a lot of different factors in politics. There's a lot of factors in war or the run-up to a war. Right before the March 19th, 2003 invasion, you could see that the Bush-Cheney administration was racing towards war, not because Iraq posed an imminent and grave danger, but because the anti-war movement was growing all over the world. Literally tens of millions of people were in the streets, so they had to kind of get it over with.
Right.
I kind of wonder if there's the same dynamic at play right now where the Moon Jae-in government in South Korea and Kim Jong-un government in North Korea are trying to race for peace. They're trying to get to the finish line whereby a fait accompli or facts on the ground are such that it makes it hard for the Trump administration to do what at least some elements within the Trump administration want to do, which is to carry out surgical strikes. Is that how you see it?
I certainly see it that way. I think the North Korean government has been slow in general. They don't normally respond this quickly. Even in a positive way, they're a slow-moving bureaucracy. So there must be some sense of crisis behind this accelerated effort. I think it's a very serious concern. I mean, basically right now, we're sort of the ball of war is already in play. It's ricocheting between Syria and North Korea. Syria seems to be favored for the place to go, although I think the Trump administration, if that's the right term for it, is capable of launching.
But the stakes are higher in Korea because should there be a war with Korea, unlike with Syria,
right?
One, North Korea has a nuclear deterrent. It has a nuclear capability. It has a missile capability that's been enhanced according with the new ICBM tests.
Right.
So the stakes are really, really high. And then you have Donald Trump, as you're mentioning. I mean, the guy gets up at the podium of the General Assembly, the premier spot for global diplomacy, and says to another member nation, we're going to totally annihilate you, or we can, and calls Kim Jong-un little rocket man. I mean, it seems like madness, but you're actually suggesting that a war with North Korea could be possible.
Well, certainly there are people who are seriously contemplating that here in Washington, D.C. I think in South Korea, I mean, people say what they have to diplomatically, but I don't think anybody, almost nobody, wants a military conflict.
So then the Trump administration aside,
right?
What would progress look like between the North and the South? What could we realistically expect to see that's positive so long as the Trump administration doesn't do something that's rash?
Well, I think we're in uncharted territory here. I mean, previously, North Korea was demanding interaction with the United States,
yes,
not with South Korea. And this is a major historical shift, maybe unprecedented, which is essentially saying engagement directly with South Korea because the stakes are so high. So what would progress look like? I think to some degree, it has to do with Japan and China buying into some sort of regional security agreement. It's not simply about North and South Korea. And I think they're going to try and ratchet it up, that to say the South Korea and the Moon Jae-in administration, to have more exchanges as quickly as possible. And it's also, it's a domestic issue. There's a group within Korea, tends to be older people. They read the same conservative newspapers that repeat the same old stories about North Korea as aliens from outer space, unlike anybody else in the world, who are inherently evil and set on destruction of the world. And they go along, often people in their 60s, 70s and above, and they exert pressure. There is support. Like in the United States, not all politics are rational, and there is a domestic element to it as well. But real progress, I personally think, can only come with some sort of comprehensive vision for what security in Northeast Asia will be. Some alternative.
Yeah. So in the past, North Korea was not really recognizing the legitimacy of the South Korean government, because South Korean government was actually a construct of the United States. In fact, the conditions of surrender with Japan in August 1945 were that the Japanese should stay in place until Douglas MacArthur and the American military forces could come to colonize Korea and set up what, in essence, is a new kind of colonialism. It's really something. I agree with you. For the North Korean government, it's not completely unprecedented, because there was the June 15, 2000 historic summit,
right,
and other moments of thaw or reconciliation. But what North Korea is saying now, and I think you're right, and I think it's an important point, It's not about U.S.-North Korean relations per se. Those are frozen. But if there's a possibility, in spite of the fact that North Korea did not treat South Korea as a legitimate government, if they have some sort of coming together between the two of them, the U.S. could be on the outside. Unlike South Korea, North Korea doesn't have to look over its shoulder and see whether some foreign country approves.
No one approves.
Even about peace, though.
Right, right.
But can the South Koreans actually exercise sovereignty? I guess that's the historic question.
Right. Well, that's an excellent question. And sovereignty, I mean, there's a legal sort of diplomatic security aspect to it, but there's also a cultural sort of self-awareness and agency issue, right? Which is much deeper sort of ideological issue. And I think that's an open question. I think March is going to be a decisive month.
Okay. Why is that? We only have a few minutes left. Why is March so important?
I think it's going to be a very critical point, whether Korea can articulate a vision for what the peninsula will be. If they do, they have a chance of, I don't know, they can end this drive for war, but
peace could break out.
From that region, from the peninsula. If they don't manage to articulate it, I think there are figures in the Trump administration who would see this as a very, and not just Trump, people out there who would see it as a great opportunity to maintain American position by creating a crisis.
Yeah, indeed. Again, we're hearing different rumors about whether or not the U.S.-South Korea military exercises will take place. They were postponed because of the Olympics. America had first said no. South Korea said yes.
Right.
Then they were postponed. Will they be postponed? Because, of course, for North Korea, each one of those exercises simulates the destruction of their country, and they never know whether a war exercise is an exercise or whether it really becomes the invasion.
Right. Well, I think we're in uncharted territory now, so I hesitate to play fortune teller on that one, but it is the question for March. It's one of the critical
ones.
What
are you hearing in South Korea?
Oh, in terms of what will go forward about the military exercises, I think they're avoiding discussing this question at this moment. So my guess is that behind the scenes, and I'm not saying this based on anything someone said to me, but that their hope is that some sort of a freeze is possible.
You've been in South Korea for 10 years.
That's correct.
You're the director of the Asia Institute. You're paying careful attention.
Right.
Is the mood shifted in a fundamental way in South Korea on this question?
On the question of North Korea?
Yes.
I think it's below the surface of the water, but yes, I think it's been a fundamental shift that people don't want to talk about it, but they really don't want a conflict with North Korea, and they want some sort of a long-term resolution.
What about the mood when those two Koreas, North and South, came in under one flag at the Olympics? Was that a genuine sort of outpouring of emotion in the South?
Hard question. So it was to some degree politically contrived, and there were many South Koreans who were not happy. The Korean Olympic team, the hockey team, had trained, and they threw out a group of people who'd spent years practicing so that they could put North Koreans in. So there was a lot of unhappiness with that. But I think the general idea that North and South Korea didn't have to be enemies, that there was a tremendous amount of sympathy.
Okay. We were very pleased to have in the studio with us Dr. Emmanuel Pastorek. He's the director of the Asia Institute in Seoul, South Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we will be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Manufacturing giant 3M agreed yesterday to pay the state of Minnesota $850 million for water quality programs after it was found to have illegally dumped dangerous chemicals in Twin Cities waterways. Those chemicals made their way into the state's groundwater. We're joined from Minneapolis by Deanna White. She's the state director for Clean Water Action. And we're also joined from Minneapolis by Sean Goshevsky. He's the executive director of Alliance for Sustainability. Welcome to both of you.
Excellent.
Thanks for having us.
Deanna, let's start with you. This lawsuit was 8 years in the making, and the Minnesota Attorney General was initially seeking well over $1 billion to pay for the damage that 3M caused. Are you pleased with the outcome of this case? And is this really going to clean up the water and the damage that 3M made?
Well, I think we're pleased that there's funding available to help address some of the issues in the East Metro. Frankly, I don't think it's going to be enough money to fix the overall problem. There's health impacts that people are dealing with. There's still contaminated water that people are dealing with. I'm disappointed that I don't think as much as $850 million is. I don't think it really is enough to fix everything that needs to be fixed. I'm also, frankly, just concerned that I'm not sure that 3M has learned its lesson in terms
right.
of dealing with toxic chemicals and the proper disposal. You know, they refuse to admit that there's any health impacts. They're treating the settlement as a way to help improve the environment of Minnesota and prove that they're good corporate citizens. And in a lot of ways, 3M does a lot of great things for the community, but I'm not sure that this goes far enough to really help them understand the full impact of their actions.
Was this a willful action on the part of 3M?
I think it was. From what I understand about the records that the Attorney General has from the company, they knew that they weren't properly disposing of the chemicals. They knew that there were problems with the chemicals and their potential impacts. They hid that information. They didn't report it and for decades. So I think that unfortunately that was a relatively common practice for a very long time in this country, that companies could dump whatever they wanted, wherever they wanted, and we're still decades later trying to figure out how to clean up the mess and how to help the people that are dealing with health impacts that you can't go back and fix.
Sean Gashevsky, 3M says that it actually followed the law at the time that it was dumping these chemicals. And the chemicals we're talking about are perfluorochemicals, PFCs. These are chemicals used in nonstick cookware, fire extinguishers, stain repellent. And they maintained in their defense in this lawsuit that the seepage into the groundwater was something that was unforeseen. It was not their fault. It was not criminal in nature. At the same time, these PFCs have made their way into people and into animals. So are there going to be controls now set up as a result of this this lawsuit that are going to protect people and animals and groundwater?
Yeah, so the issue is that the PFC molecules fall underwater, and so then they can distribute very rapidly, and they have covered 100 square miles, and it's impossible to get it out of the groundwater. So basically, the settlement is helping cities retrofit their water treatment systems to have better filters to get the PFCs out of there. And then they're also helping to create additional areas for fishing and things so that the people who had been fishing in areas that are contaminated and you can't eat the fish with PFCs can fish elsewhere. So it'll be a lot of work with different municipalities to connect people with wells into the city water systems. It also goes into a much bigger issue of, unfortunately, people love their lawns and they water them too much in the summer, which is unsustainable for the overall aquifer. And so the cities are being asked by our Metropolitan Council to figure out a way to balance that and potentially have to use other surface water being pumped in from the St. Croix or Mississippi eventually. But if we got rid of watering our lawns and just had fescue grass, we would have basically balance between our water usage and the aquifer recharge.
We're speaking with Deanna White from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's the State Director for Clean Water Action. And we're speaking also from Minneapolis by Sean Gashevsky. He's the Executive Director of Alliance for Sustainability. We're talking about a recent settlement in the state of Minnesota between the state and the giant manufacturer 3M. 3M had been dumping poisonous chemicals in the water system there. Deanna, let's go back to you. Are you concerned that there are other companies dumping chemicals? Are there other waterborne chemicals that we should be worried about besides what 3M has admitted it's responsible for?
I mean, there are an incredible number of toxic chemicals that are being put into our air and water and bodies every single day. One of the issues that we've worked on for a long time here at Clean Water Action is trying to address the broken system of dealing with toxic chemicals in this country. We have a federal law called the Toxic Substances Control Act that was passed in 1976 and has done very little to allow the EPA to regulate or require the phase out or ban of any chemicals. We know there's a problem. The problem is that companies are allowed to use chemicals without proving that they're safe. And that's exactly what happened with this chemical that 3M produced. They put the chemical out there and didn't look fully at the health impacts, or if they were aware that there were health impacts, they didn't share that information. And so there's very little ability for the government to be able to force companies to address the health impacts of these chemicals. And so we're left with dealing with what happens to them when they get dumped or disposed of. And sometimes even when they're disposed properly, it still doesn't fully capture the health, protect us from the health impacts.
Yeah,
so
no.
I can tell you for a fact that, yeah, unfortunately, this is not the only situation where this is happening.
Deanna, I want to ask you and Sean the same question. I mean, corporations are and the corporate CEOs are answering to the board and to the investors, and they're trying to come up with the best quarterly report possible for maximizing profit. That's all they really actually care about. Of course, you have legal issues that are legal actions like this that might create injunctive relief, but they're just trying to make money. And of course, the government and the law gives them a lot of leeway and a lot of right. It's sort of like the profits of corporations come before people or before our environment or before our community. And Deanna, you had asked or mentioned earlier, I'm not sure any of these corporate polluters, 3M in this case, have really, really learned their lesson. Why are there never any criminal penalties? Like, it would seem to me that that would certainly gain the attention of CEOs if people actually went to jail for poisoning our environment.
Well, one of the biggest challenges is that because of the way human beings are engineered, it's almost impossible to prove direct causality between an exposure when you were a child to something in your drinking water and to the fact that you later on developed cancer or thyroid disease or liver damage. So while we can test and know that the chemicals likely cause these things, it's almost impossible for an individual to say, I have cancer because I drank the water in the East Metro. It's just not the way medicine and medical testing and disease
I got you on that. But
yeah.
In other words, it's hard for a right of action for an individual to say, I got my cancer because of 3M's policies. But we can have policies and laws that stop this from happening. And then if the corporations break those laws, then there's culpability. And I'm just wondering whether, because corporations sort of do money crunching or numbers crunching, they pay fines, and sometimes there's not a big change that happens. Anyway,
right. Sean, the fines aren't big enough.
Well, there is another
tough enough.
Yeah,
there is another bigger picture of both 3M and other. We have a lot of Fortune 500 companies here that are in the Twin Cities that are part of what is called the Circular Economy Initiative, where they're looking at how to have closed loop cycles of materials and renewable energy. And then that ties into the Green Chemistry Initiative that 3M is a founding partner on with the U of M. So one of the more basic issues is teaching chemists as they're being trained in college what organic molecules look like and how to make other new chemicals that are not toxic and hazardous, and that they don't mimic the normal molecules that our bodies uptake a lot. So there is a bigger picture of companies trying to reduce their legal liability as well as the cost of using toxic chemicals. So 3M, in a lot of its processes, is not using hazardous solvents. They're using water. And so just Google the Green Chemistry Initiative, and that's one of the long-term solutions how to move forward out of this mess.
We've got about 60 seconds left. I want to tell both of you that this story got a lot of national play. This is just not just a local Minneapolis or local Minnesota story. It was in the Washington Post today, the New York Times, the LA Times, even the Wall Street Journal. Do you think that that is going to deter anybody? Is the coverage going to deter other companies from polluting our air and water?
Deanna, you get the last word. Go ahead.
I'm not sure that the coverage will deter them from doing it. I think that they will do a better job of changing the system and influencing the policies so that they're not punished for it. I think the biggest challenge we have is that these companies have an unlimited amount of political power right now, and they're getting to write the rules.
Yep.
And as long as that's the case, it's going to be really tough to hold these polluters accountable. I do think one of the strategies we've been trying to use is to get people to use their power as consumers to start asking questions about what's in products, what the process is for making them, how things are disposed of, and making different buying decisions. And while that won't solve the problem, it at least helps drive the market to change, and it helps people protect themselves a little bit until the government's ready to step up and do it for us.
Indeed, it does. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Minneapolis by Deanna White, the State Director for Clean Water Action, and we were also joined from Minneapolis by Sean Goshevsky. He's the Executive Director of Alliance for Sustainability. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An Idaho lawmaker has introduced a new bill that would allow health insurance carriers to offer non-Obamacare-approved plans while also imposing new requirements for Medicaid recipients. If passed, many health insurance plans in Idaho would not meet the minimum requirements set by Obamacare. We're joined here in the studio by Leo Cuello. He's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So if you just take a quick glance at this and you are either someone who's not political or you're conservative in your outlook, you're going to say, hey, this is a good idea. This is going to insure more people than otherwise would have been insured. But in fact, that's not really true, is it? It's going to give people insurance that may not be adequate to cover their needs and may end up costing them more in the long run, would it not?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, if you look at this, it's like a lot of the other things that have sort of come through this administration. It is both a bad policy and it's not legal. And so as a matter of policy, what's wrong with it is it is likely to create some really cheap, low-value plans that a small group of people who are very healthy enroll in, but then there's no coverage left that's stable for people who have, you know, predictable healthcare needs. So it's actually a really destructive force for the market as a whole. And, you know, that's sort of the Republican premise is a sort of law of the jungle approach on healthcare, right? It's sort of we're gonna let the free market do what it wants to do. And that leads to competition, but the competition it leads to is plans trying to go after the healthiest people. And they do that through a variety of techniques. And what ends up happening is you have plans fighting to get all the young, healthy men who don't have chronic conditions, who aren't going to get pregnant, and we end up with an individual marketplace where the plans literally don't even cover maternity benefits, which is where we were before the Affordable Care Act. So you're right. The result is plans that offer much less value, and they break the risk pool apart, creating coverage options for healthy people, but making it all the harder for unhealthy people to get covered.
Bad policy. Why is it not legal?
So the reason it's not legal is the Affordable Care Act sets out a series of requirements for what an insurance plan must do. For example, it has to cover certain essential health benefits. As you may have heard, right, they're not supposed to put dollar caps on what your coverage is anymore. Obviously, most people know about the big pre-existing conditions exclusions not being allowed anymore, right? And this would just proceed without doing any of those things. And, it's so legally, it's hard to wrap your brain. It's a little bit like if I said, I'm going to get in my car now and drive to the moon. It's hard to even know how to engage with this because they have said, we don't need any waivers to do this. We're just going to do it. It clearly violates the law. And so it just raises this question of whether the state of Idaho is going to proceed violating the law and whether HHS is just going to look the other way and say, we're okay with you violating the law,
yeah,
and whether this is going to turn into another lawsuit that never should have happened.
That's really the question. This is a political issue. Is the Trump administration going to just allow Idaho to get away with this by not suing the state, which then would encourage other states to violate the law just like Idaho is? Or is the Trump administration going to put itself in an odd position where it's forced to defend Obamacare in court?
Right. I mean, you know, from the point of view of HHS, I don't think it would ever get to a lawsuit. I think HHS would be able to work something out with Idaho. You know, what Idaho might eventually do, what I was kind of expecting one day they would do, is come back and start looking for waivers, start looking for permissions, go through the legal process to get permission to not follow the rules. And we may yet see that.
And there is a waiver provision?
So in the marketplace, we've talked about waivers before in the Medicaid context.
Yes.
There is a separate waiver authority for the marketplace. It's called Section 1332. And it does allow states to get exceptions to some of the requirements around the marketplace, such as, for example, that essential health benefits package. However, there are what we call the four guardrails, and there are basically these requirements that set out limits as to what you can do. So you can't actually reduce the quality of the services people get. You can't increase the costs on those people. You can't increase the costs on the federal government, so it has to be deficit neutral. So are these provisions in, and you can't reduce the number of people who could be covered. So those are the kind of four guardrails. So that will raise a fight about whether they could ever get a waiver to do this plan, which looks very clearly like it's going to result in a whole bunch of people losing access to coverage and having some people having to pay more for coverage, et cetera.
Is there a right of action, legal action for non-government entities?
So that is the private right of action is an issue that is itself being litigated in the courts. So I'm gonna steer clear of commenting on that. What I will say is, if Idaho went ahead and did this the way they've said it, it's inevitable this would lead to a lawsuit filed by somebody somewhere because of the fact that this is totally counter to the explicit requirements of the Affordable Care Act, and not one requirement, many requirements. So for example, Idaho somehow thinks that they're going to do this, create these plans that are non-compliant with the ACA requirements, and that people are going to continue to be eligible for the subsidies to purchase these plans. The law clearly states that subsidies are only available for plans that are on the exchange meeting the requirements. So, you know, they need a series of miracles for this to be legal, like me driving my car to the moon.
The second part of this thing, too, is the imposition, or what would be the imposition of certain requirements on Medicaid recipients, similar to what we talked about in Kentucky the last time you were here. Is it really the same, or is this something different? Is this something that Idaho is going to have to ask for a waiver for as well?
So, you know, any change they want to make to the Medicaid program that doesn't comply with federal law, they would need waivers for. I think the Idaho situation is a little different in that it's very early on in the process, in the sense that you know, they haven't put together a formal Medicaid application that that the state is going to present to HHS, and that's going to go through the formal notice and comment period. So what's going to happen in Idaho is still a little speculative at this point. It's very different than a state like Kentucky, Indiana, or one of the other states that has applied for a Medicaid waiver, where it's very clear that they have officially requested something and is officially being considered.
Leo, let's ask you, because you are an expert both on policy and the Affordable Care Act and on the issue of law, what's actually taking place within the confines or within the context of the Affordable Care Act? We have a situation where the Affordable Care Act, in many cases, isn't all that affordable, and in some ways is becoming less affordable. I want to help have the audience understand, and maybe you can help us understand why that's true. I know I have a family member who's been getting a regular daily medicine for a long time. That person just had the medicine cost a lot more. It didn't double, but it cost a lot more after the first of the year. Why is that happening?
So you know, the individual marketplace was totally under and undeveloped prior to the Affordable Care Act, right? So you had all these people who weren't in it at all, and then you had the people who were in it who are what we call underinsured, right? They didn't have a product that was a good product. And now you've suddenly created this new marketplace, and it is going to take time for that marketplace to stabilize and for coverage to stabilize. At the end of the day, what is going to drive down costs are more people in this marketplace, including healthy people, and creating controls on some of the things that are out of the box drivers of cost, like, let's say, pharmaceuticals, right? So those are going to be the types of things that will, over the long term, control cost. One of the issues, right, is that the writers of the Affordable Care Act sort of guessed, okay, how much do we think people can afford? And we're going to subsidize them, you know, with that assumption in mind. And maybe that assumption wasn't generous enough. Maybe, in fact, what people need is slightly more subsidization. And we've certainly seen that at the lower income end of the spectrum, where what people were expected to pay feels like a little bit too much for them, and especially when they're healthy and not using the insurance, right? And then that gets you into the problem of the healthy people drop out and the sicker people stay in, and that causes costs to go up more quickly. So we need to figure out a bunch of strategies to improve the amount of people that are healthy in this marketplace and able to afford coverage. And the conclusory point that I don't want to get lost is this marketplace was a disaster before the ACA. The ACA came in and cleaned shop in an insurance market where, as we said earlier, more than half the plans weren't providing maternity coverage, right? It was a joke. So what we have now isn't perfect. It needs to get better, but we are moving in the right direction.
In the last 30 seconds or so, can you tell us, are there any states that are moving in the opposite direction, shoring up Obamacare, making it more affordable or easier to access?
Yeah, so there are a lot of states that are considering new ideas, new ways to expand coverage, thinking about ways, for example, to let people in the marketplace buy into their Medicaid program. It raises a lot of questions. It could potentially raise problems, but they're doing it with the explicit intention of trying to create more options, including in counties that have a low amount of plans available.
Okay, we will leave it there, but it's certainly an issue we're going to come back to. We were joined here in the studio by Leo Cuello. Leo is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou here in the studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Senator Mike Enzi, a conservative Republican from Wyoming and the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, has sent a letter to the Pentagon saying that if the Defense Department can't manage its own accounting, then perhaps Congress may have to withhold that huge budget increase it just passed. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Lawrence Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was formerly director of national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he was assistant secretary of defense during the Reagan administration. Welcome back, Dr. Korb.
Nice to be with you again.
Tell me, how serious is this threat from Senator Enzi? He's usually a very taciturn, quiet, thoughtful kind of senator. It's unusual for him to come out and make a threat like this.
Well, it is, but a couple of things have happened in the past year that I think have highlighted it. First of all, about a year ago, the Defense Business Board, which is appointed by the Secretary of Defense to take a look at how they run things, came up and said, you guys could save $25 billion a year over the next 5 years by just trimming what they call the back office staff, or, you know, the size of the bureaucracy. So you know what the Pentagon did? They tried to bury the report. Oof. And they fired the head of the Defense Business Board, because I testified about a year ago on this before the House Government Oversight Committee. Next thing that happened is the Pentagon, the government agency since 1992, are supposed to, you know, be subject to an audit. The Pentagon finally had their first one done this year, the Defense Logistics Agency. You know what they found? There was $800 million they couldn't account for. Now, when you couple that with raising the budget to levels, even if you control for inflation, that were higher than we spent under Reagan, which, as you mentioned, I had the privilege, you know, of serving, more than the Cold War average, more than Vietnam, you got to ask yourself, well, with all that money, is there really an incentive to try and save things?
Right. You know, the last time you were on the show, we talked about the Defense Logistics Agency and this missing money, hundreds of millions of dollars. This is something that has not been lost on ENSI. I would note that Politico has covered this letter to Secretary Mattis, and it's quite strong in its language. Senator ENSI says here, and I quote, "Taxpayers must have trust and confidence that their hard-earned dollars are being spent wisely. If such trust and confidence cannot be built and justified, it will be incredibly difficult to achieve the 3-5% real growth in defense spending that you have identified as required to meet mission requirements." Unquote. That's a threat, if I've ever heard one.
Well, it is, and I think it's good. See, one of the problems you've had is Mattis, Secretary Mattis. First of all, he's a military guy, and he's a great man. I'm certainly happy that he's one of the adults working for Trump. But you don't want a military person running, you know, a military organization, because they have a much different view than a manager, you know, like a Robert, you know, McNamara, or even Dick Cheney, who was a very good Secretary of Defense, by the way, when it came to managing the place. The other is it took him forever to get his team in there, so nobody's really been doing the stuff that they should be. So, yeah, I think it should get their attention, but, you know, so much has been focused by the president on throwing money at them. And, you know, I mean, just, you know, $716 billion for defense, you know, we already spend more than the next 10 countries in the world combined.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's saying, well, you know, the Chinese and the Russia, yeah, we spend 3 times more than China, 10 times more than Russia. Now, if they're able to do things, you have to ask yourself, well, you know, what are we doing that we should not? So, yeah, when you have this money, people don't pay attention the way they should. When I worked in government, you may remember, even young kids who weren't even alive then, when I speak on college campuses, what we spent for toilet seats. And you know who did that? The Defense Logistics Agency.
I'm looking at a media story. A Pentagon profligacy makes headlines with reports. This was back in 1985. I don't know what your position was at that time, whether you were in the Assistant Secretary of Defense.
I was Assistant Secretary for Manpower, Installations, and Logistics. And what happened is they called me into the front office and said, we want you to handle this situation. I said, well, I'm not in procurement. I didn't buy it. And they said, yeah, but you're glib. So
yeah, so that was the, and help us understand, how did that happen? There was the reports, well, were 600, let me just say it, and then, because people who weren't there, people too young might not remember, $640 toilet seats, $660 ashtrays, $7,600 coffee makers, $74,000 ladders. I mean, these were the sort of dramatic numbers about what costs were being, you know, what money was being spent on Pentagon things. Obviously, $660 ashtray or a $640 toilet seat, just, it blew people's minds. Go ahead.
Well, it did. And what I did is I took that as an opportunity to work on a lot of other areas. In fact, I was on Face the Nation with Senator Grassley one day, and we were talking about this, and I said, yeah, you know, you're right, Senator. We've got to do better. And I got the price down to $100, you know, by negotiating with Lockheed. But I said, there's things that you guys are doing that are costing us a lot of money. And he agreed.
But was the $100 for the ashtray or the toilet seat?
Well, the toilet seat. That's the only one I worked on.
I got it.
Didn't get into the others. But in fact, it was, to me, I remember talking to the head of Lockheed. And he said, oh, he had every right to do it. And I said, look, even aside from the fact whether you're right or wrong, it's going to kill. It's going to cost you $10 billion and other things if you don't do something about this. And see, that's what I think. You know, it's very hard for a man or woman who's very busy doing, you know, the stuff that they need to do to, you know, make ends meet and keep their family intact and everything, to know how much an F-35, you know, fighter should cost. But they sure as heck know what a toilet seat should cost. And they also know what happens when you get an audit and you can't account for money, that they can relate to.
Dr. Corbett, help us understand the Capitol Hill politics around this issue. This letter to Secretary Mattis came from, as we said, Mike Enzi, who's the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. It did not come from John McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Should we read into that anything? Is there any division between the two?
Well, I think it's what they focus on. Senator McCain is focused on, you know, can we fight the wars? How can, deal with the threats that we face? In fact, Senator McCain has been very critical of them, cost overruns in the Department of Defense. I'm putting out something, and I put it in my testimony last year when I testified on the budget, of the 50 major Western systems that go, they got a $500 billion cost overruns. And he's the one who's been complaining about that. So, yeah, he is. I mean, he is. He wants to have a strong, robust defense, but he wants to make sure that, we don't spend money we shouldn't. And he's talked about canceling weapon systems like the Littoral Combat Ship, which is way over budget and it can't even carry out its missions. And he said, cut back on the number of F-35s that you're buying.
Lawrence Korb is our guest. We're talking about Pentagon waste and about what's going on inside the U.S. Senate. Dr. Korb, the budget, as I understand it, the Trump White House sent over a budget proposal to the Congress, and Congress actually upped the military budget, the Defense Department budget, this year. And then we have the lifting of spending caps so that there could be, in fact, another $170 billion over the next 2 years on top of this already, I would consider to be extremely bloated military budget. Dwight Eisenhower warned in his last farewell address about the danger of a military-industrial complex. Why does this happen over and over again? Does it incentivize conflict?
Well, yeah, because what happens when you're such a large agency and, the American people want to defend themselves and, and quite rightly, our military has great respect for, what they do and put their lives on the line for us. So there it becomes comparatively easy to do that, except when you get to things people can relate to, like a toilet seat, for example. And what happened was last year, Trump proposed a budget and he increased what, Obama's budget had been. Obama had presented a budget on the way out. He upped it, and then Congress upped it by another $85 billion. And then when they did that budget deal, to keep the government from closing down, they put that number into law for the fiscal year 18 budget. So that comes to about $700 billion as opposed to, what Obama had proposed, which was like $585 or something. And then you have the 19 budget, which they agreed on that deal would be $716 billion.
We will have to leave it there. That was the voice of Dr. Lawrence Korb. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was formerly Director of National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.